before I actually start to talking about anatomy and physiology, I'll say something about the slideshows. They are mostly, in my course, in my ones that I teach, they are mostly pictures from the textbook. Very little text. And I do that on purpose because I used to have text in my slides, and I noticed that if I had text up there, students would just be ignoring me and writing exactly what the text was, like they had to write it down, which when you think about it is kind of foolish, total waste of time, because you already have the slideshows, right, on the website, so why copy it by hand? And copying it distracts you from listening to me, so I basically am trying to force you to listen to me by not having much text up there. But I also have a red slide number on each slide, and I'll try to always mention what slide I'm on so that when you do listen to the recordings at home, you know which slide to be looking at while you listen to it. And I really recommend that you, when you're in your notes, draw a line every time I change slides and label your slides in your notes. Because like I said, what you write down in here should not be your final version of your notes. You should then go back home, listen to the recordings, and make those notes much better, slide by slide. Okay. We should start, I guess, since this is anatomy and physiology, we should start by defining those terms. Who wants to define either one of those? Or what is the difference between them, anatomy and physiology? What is anatomy? Now, is everyone just afraid to answer, or does everyone have no idea at all what anatomy is? Yeah?
Anatomy is the study of the structure and the shape of the body and its parts and the relationships to one another.
Almost sounds like you read that.
I did.
Yeah, anatomy is all about structure, how things are built, whereas physiology is about function, how those structures do their job, in other words. And they're very highly related because of how evolution works. The structures of organs and other parts has come to be that way by evolution simply because that's what works. That's what works well. And natural selection favors things that work well. Those things get passed on to offspring. The things that don't work well, those organisms don't survive, and they therefore don't pass those traits on to the offspring in the next population. Okay, so form fits function. Anatomy fits physiology, in other words, because of natural selection. But if we talk just about anatomy, the structure of things, you can consider it at multiple levels. For instance, what we're looking at here, this wouldn't have to be a digestive system, this is just an example. This is gross anatomy. And gross doesn't mean disgusting here. Gross anatomy means coarse, not fine. Not fine details. Macroscopic, big stuff. Like major organs. Small and large intestine, for instance, are part of gross anatomy. You can get finer detail, though. In slide 2, we can see a closer look. Within the stomach, which is part of gross anatomy of the digestive system, we can look at an extreme close-up of just this little box right here at the tissue lining the interior of the stomach. And that is, when you look at this fine detail, that's microscopic anatomy, because each of these little things right here is a cell. Cells are tiny. They're invisible individually to the human eye. So this is microscopic anatomy, much finer detail. Cell, by the way, I should mention some important things about cells. The cell is the functional unit of life. What I mean is that anything that is living, which is an organism, has to have at least one cell. That's a strict requirement for being an organism. Have to have at least one cell. Now, there are some organisms that have only one cell. In fact, in terms of individuals, most organisms have one cell. by far most organisms alive now and that have ever lived are bacteria. Drastically far and away the most successful organisms that have ever lived. An individual bacterium is just one cell. So they're examples of unicellular organisms, and there are many others. But we, as animals, are examples of multicellular organisms. So we're still organisms because we have at least one cell, but we have more than one cell, obviously, right? Do you have any idea how many cells are in your body as a typical adult human?
1 trillion.
That's pretty close, but it's closer to 100 trillion. 10 to 100 trillion, depending on your size. So a billion cells, which is a huge number, right? That's really a tiny piece of your body. Cells are so small that a billion doesn't take up much room. By the way, the 100 trillion cells that are in a typical human, those are your cells, the ones that you can claim ownership to, in a sense. Because what I mean by that is that those are the ones with your own DNA, the cells of your body. You know, we occupy a certain space. We say, this is me, this is my body. But in terms of cells, what is occupying that space you call your body is mostly other kinds of cells. Because even though you have 100 trillion cells, roughly, for every one of your own cells, there's between 10 and 100 bacteria that live in and on you. They're much smaller than your own cells. And so they are really, what you call your body is mostly bacteria and only a little bit of your own cells. But anyway, without a cell, if you don't have any cell at all, you're not by definition an organism. Like, for instance, a virus. A virus you might consider to be a living thing. It's not a living thing. Now, it's a biological thing or a biotic entity, meaning that it's involved in biology, but it's not an organism. It's not living. To be living means to be metabolizing. Metabolism really is life. Now, what is the definition of metabolism? Now, you've heard this word, certainly. But how would you say, what would you say metabolism is if you were teaching a kid who's never heard the word? What is metabolism? Yeah, that's all involved in metabolism. Metabolism, as a definition, a scientific definition, refers to the sum of all the chemical reactions that are occurring within an organism. And there are not only thousands of reactions, there's actually quadrillions of reactions going on in your body at any given moment. There are thousands of different kinds of reactions just in one cell. But anyway, you add up all those chemical reactions that are occurring, that is your metabolism. And really, that is life. What we call life is metabolism. It's chemical reactions. And those chemical reactions, in order to work correctly, need to be in their own little test tubes, separated away from the rest of the universe, just like in a test tube, right? We put things in test tubes so that there's no interference with the surroundings and things can happen in it. Well, that's really what a cell is, a tiny test tube sequestered away from the universe so that the chemistry of life, metabolism, can occur inside it. And each one of these is a cell in this lining of the stomach. So that's a closer view. That's looking at anatomy at a different level, but you can get even finer detail like we see in slide 3. This is just a close-up of one of those pits that were in the previous slide. You can see cells again here, but the difference here is that now we're focusing on just one cell rather than this whole tissue. Just one cell, and you can talk about the anatomy of a single cell because there are pieces within the cell called organelles. That's cellular anatomy. And you can talk about cellular physiology too. That thing that's at the top is an example of one of these thousands of chemical reactions that I was referring to when I talked about metabolism. pepsinogen gets turned into pepsin. That's one chemical reaction, part of metabolism. By the way, just in case you're curious about this example, pepsinogen is a molecule that we classify as a proenzyme. Pro means before. So a proenzyme is not an enzyme, but a proenzyme can be turned into an enzyme. And that's what's happening here. Pepsin is the actual active enzyme. Proenzyme gets converted into pepsin with the help of HCl. What is HCl? Anyone know? That's hydrochloric acid, which is abundant in gastric juice, the stuff that your stomach makes. Your stomach is very acidic, by far the most acidic part of your body, and therefore the most inhospitable part of your body in terms of other things besides your cells living there. This is why, for instance, you know, you're getting a steady stream of bacteria put into your mouth all the time, because there's no avoiding bacteria. Most of them don't do you any harm, and actually, you know, most of them that are in and on your body, you actually require. You can't live without them. But some of them can obviously do you harm, right? So those coming in through the mouth all the time, and we're swallowing, not continuously, but every several seconds, we're swallowing, whether we're eating or not, right? We're always swallowing. Well, that pushes these bacteria that are coming in down into the stomach, where it's so acidic that most species are killed there, and that protects us. But another thing that hydrochloric acid does is activate this proenzyme, turn it into the enzyme. Pepsin then does its job as a digestive enzyme to break down proteins that are in the food that's in that stomach. Anyway, that's a lot finer detail than gross anatomy in physiology. Okay, let's go to 4. Here we're looking at the hierarchy of biological organization. Now, a hierarchy is a nested arrangement. I say it's nested, you know, like those little nested dolls. You open one up and there's a smaller version inside. Because a hierarchy has a level, or has levels, each level will then contain some number of levels within that level. And then those levels each will contain certain levels within that. And the organization of biology is like this. We're going to go through this in the order that it's numbered, which is from small to large. Starting with the chemical level, as you see. Now, the chemical level deals with atoms and molecules, which really are, strictly speaking, two levels of themselves, but we're lumping them into one in this course. Atoms and molecules are unimaginably small. Cells are already invisible, right? That's pretty small. But cells are big enough to have many, many millions of atoms and molecules in them. So atoms and molecules are truly, truly tiny things. But everything in the universe that is material, that's made out of matter, in other words, rather other than, you know, there's energy and there's matter. All the things that are made of matter are made of atoms of different kinds. The atoms of different kinds that we'll talk more about in the chemistry part of it are listed on the periodic table over there. So there's helium atoms, there's calcium atoms, and so on. Well, these are truly tiny things. It takes trillions and trillions of them before you are even have enough to just barely see. They're so small. Atoms, though, of different kinds combine to form larger, slightly larger, still very small, but larger and more complex structures called molecules. And I should mention that every time we go up in level here, like from atoms to molecules, for instance, but all of these steps, we encounter, let me see if I have this darker, what are called emergent properties. Now, what does it mean to emerge? just in everyday language. Emerge means to come out. Emergent properties is a phrase that refers to the fact that at each of these levels, that level will feature properties that the lower levels do not feature. And that's an important part of biological organization. For instance, at the levels that we're still talking about, atoms and molecules, hydrogen atoms and oxygen atoms are what are required to build a water molecule. Water is H2O, right? It's two hydrogens and an oxygen. When you build that and you now have a water molecule, that water molecule has properties that neither of the atoms has, right? The water molecule is watery. It is water. The hydrogen atom is not watery. The oxygen atom is not watery. So that new property emerged at that higher level. It came out. And that's true for all of these levels. Each level features properties that lower levels do not. If we go up one from the chemical level, we are at the cellular level. So molecules of various types make up the stuff that's in and is a cell, which I've already said is the functional unit of life, right? You can't be alive without at least one cell. So that's the next level. And cells have properties that molecules themselves don't. That's another emergent property example. Now, if you only have one cell, the rest of these levels wouldn't apply. But we're not talking about unicellular organisms in this course. We're talking about humans. So all of these apply for humans. Humans are multicellular, so that simply means that they have more than one cell, however many it is, it's more than one. But more than just being multicellular, we are made up of different kinds of cells, right? We all started out as one cell. You started out as a zygote, which was the one cell produced when your father's sperm and your mother's egg fused together. But then that one cell, that zygote, split into two, and those into four, and then into eight, and so on. It kept doubling. Very early embryo, right after zygote, when you were just a few cells big, those cells were pretty much identical. But then once you have enough cells produced, they start to develop into different kinds of cells. And obviously by the time you're adult, you have all kinds of different cells, right? You don't have 100 trillion identical cells. You have kidney cells, you have liver cells, and so on. They have gone down different developmental paths to become different kinds of cells. And so different cells collect and organize into larger structures called tissues. And depending on the species, there's different numbers of tissues, but for humans, there's a specific number of tissues. Any feel for how many tissues you are made out of as a human? No guess? It's a good guess. It's way too high, though. It's four. It's actually only four tissue types make you up. So if you take a spoonful of your body from wherever, there's going to be at most four tissues in that spoonful. We'll talk about tissues in more detail later, but let me just tell you what they are. They are epithelial tissue, which forms layers like your skin. The touchable part of your skin, for example, is an example of an epithelium. There's nervous tissue, which is obviously important in your brain and the rest of the nervous system. There's muscular tissue, which helps move you around and move parts of your body. And there is connective tissue, which is basically everything else. It includes blood and bone and all kinds of things. So anyway, that's the tissue level. Collections of cells specialized for a certain function. Tissues of different types then organize into even more complex structures called organs. All right, now, I'm sure you're familiar with certain organs. What are some examples of organs? Heart, lungs, skin is the largest one. You know, there's a lot of organs. Eyes, those are all made of multiple tissues, but they're organized in such a way that that overall organ has a specific function. And so, once again, emergent properties. The eyeball has properties that the individual tissues that make it up do not have on their own. Okay, and then multiple organs that are different make even more complex arrangements called organ systems. And that organ system as a whole will perform a specific set of functions. For instance, the first slide, I think, used the digestive system as an example, didn't it? That's an example of an organ system. There's not just one organ in it, right? There's stomach, liver, small intestine, so on. Teeth. That's all part of the same organ system because the organs are doing different things, but they're doing it for the purpose of a common goal for the overall digestion and other functions that the digestive system has. Depending on the species, there's some number of organ systems, but for humans, which is the species we care about in this course, there are 11. And so once we get through some introductory material in these first couple meetings, the whole rest of the term is really going to be a survey of all the 11 human organ systems one by one. We're going to look at closer detail on each one for the rest of the term. Okay, and we'll mention those 11 in a little bit, but there are 11 for humans. Well, when you, in the case of humans, consider all 11 of those organ systems, then collecting together, what you have is the entire organism, which is one individual human. And so that's the highest level that we'll look at in this course. You can actually go above that if you're talking about just general biology rather than human anatomy, because organisms can then collect into populations and then populations into communities and so on, all the way up to the biosphere. But that's a different course. Okay. Well, since we mentioned that there are 11 human organ systems, let's have a whirlwind tour of them. We're not going to focus on these too much. Like I said, we'll individually look at these in their own chapters. But just to give you the 11 names. There's no particular order to these. They're all vitally important. There's none that you can't live without, that you can live without. But we're starting here with the integumentary system. Now, integumentary is just the adjective form of integument, which means covering. So the integumentary system includes the skin, which is the major covering of your body, the outer covering. But it's more than that. It also includes the hair and the nails. Now, we have hair because we are mammals. We're not only animals, more specifically than that, we are mammals, and all mammals are able to produce hair. Only mammals are able to produce hair. So other creatures have things that kind of look like hair, but true hair is made only by mammals, including humans. So those are all involved in the integumentary system. And it's something that we really focus on cosmetically. You know, we care about how we appear to others, and that integumentary system is really the only system that you can view without dissecting a human. So we put a lot of time and money into making our integumentary system presentable to other people. But just in terms of health, it's a really important system. We would die quickly without the skin. You know, if we didn't have that outer covering, there's many reasons we would die. For one thing, we would dry out. We would desiccate because all of those moist organs that have to be moist in order to be alive, they would just lose their water. Since we are terrestrial organisms, we don't live in water, we live in the air, we would dry out. So the skin is fairly waterproof, for one thing. But we would also die from infection pretty quickly because the skin is a barrier protecting us from invading microorganisms. So it does other important things as well, by the way. It's really important in maintenance of temperature. You know, when you see a person whose skin is flushed, looks really red, it's because they're hot, and blood is being sent more than usual to that part of the body. Blood carries heat from the core of the body, and that heat then is dumped to the environment conductively when you bring it close to the surface. We also adjust our temperature with the integumentary system by sweating. Right, the sweat glands are in the skin, so that's part of the integumentary system. And by sweating, we're moistening the, you know, sweat is mostly water. Put that on the surface of the skin, and then that evaporates. And when you evaporate anything, the temperature goes down. Just like an evaporative cooler, if you happen to have one in your house, it works exactly the same way, evaporation of water. All right, let's look at another one in 6. Slide 6 shows the skeletal system, which obviously involves the skeleton. Now, a skeleton is important as a rigid framework to give the body, you know, just to keep the body from being a blob that just collapses. It has a skeleton. Now, we are examples of organisms that have an endoskeleton, endo meaning inside. Our rigid framework is inside our body. Whereas certain animals have an exoskeleton. Insects are like this, right? Think of a beetle. Its soft parts are all inside it, and it's wearing basically armor on its outside. That's an exoskeleton. But we have an endoskeleton, the bones. And obviously the bones are included in the skeletal system, but also included in that, structurally speaking, are cartilages and ligaments. And we'll talk more about those when we get to the skeleton chapter. It's more than just about being a framework, though. The bones provide rigid structures on which muscles can pull. That's what muscles do. That's the only thing muscles can do. All they can do is pull on things. They can only shorten on their own. They can never push. So when they pull, if they don't have something to pull on, they wouldn't be doing anything useful. The skeleton is the things... The bones of the skeleton are the things that the muscles pull on, allowing us to bend our joints, walk around, and so on. But beyond that, the skeleton is also really important as a huge repository, a huge storage for calcium. Calcium is important for the hardness of the bones, but calcium is also vitally important for the operation of the cells, especially the nervous system and the muscular system. Without calcium, our brain wouldn't work, our muscles wouldn't work, we would be dead. So when extra is needed, it's taken out of the skeleton and put into the blood so those other cells can have it. Well, speaking of the muscles, slide 7 shows you the muscular system. This is kind of a little confusing. When we get into tissues, I'll tell you with greater detail later that there are really 3 kinds of muscle, and you don't have to know this right now, but the 3 kinds are skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, muscle of the heart, and smooth muscle. And you might think, reasonably enough, that the muscular system includes all 3 of those muscle types, but it actually doesn't. Cardiac muscle makes up the heart. It's part of a different system. Smooth muscle is part of several different systems, but it's not part of the muscular system. The muscular system includes only skeletal muscle and tendons, but I mean, as far as muscle is concerned, it contains only skeletal muscle, which are muscles that connect to bone. That's why they're called skeletal muscle, obviously. So these are the things, you know, these are the muscles that we really think about day to day. We tend not to think about our cardiac muscle or our smooth muscle, even though it's important. You know, we think about the muscles that are moving us around, and especially people who are trying to bulk up, you know, through exercise, that those are skeletal muscles that those people are making bigger through using those muscles over and over. This also is important in maintenance of heat, of temperature, by the way. How do skeletal muscles help in maintaining our temperature? And you know what I'm talking about? Well, when it gets too cold, what do you start doing? Shivering. Right. And shivering is really just, rather than it being coordinated motion, which skeletal muscle activity usually is, coordinated so that you're pulling in one direction on a bone, shivering is uncoordinated muscle contraction, not to move a body part, but just to create friction, which heats you up. Slide 8, the nervous system. Like I said before, every one of these 11 organ systems is vitally important, but it's kind of hard to imagine life without a nervous system, because really, you know, what we identify as ourselves is the brain. The brain is, you know, what we call our mind is really the activity of our brain. Our brain is our existence. In fact, we define death by death of the brain. You can have a part of your body other than your brain die. You're still considered alive, but not your brain. Your brain is you, really. The brain is only one part of the nervous system, though. The overall nervous system, by the way, is an example, one of two control systems. Now, they're called control systems because these two organ systems have the job of controlling the other 9 organ systems. Now, what is the other control system? Nervous system is one. It controls the whole body, basically. The which one? No, the endocrine system. The endocrine system controls the body with its own signals. The nervous system controls the body with a different type of signals. For the nervous system, the signals that tell the rest of the body what to do are electrochemical signals. And they're sent along neurons, specialized cells in the nervous system. And so this happens quickly. The control exerted by the nervous system is very fast-acting control. It takes a tiny fraction of a second, for instance, for a impulse to be sent from your foot, if you step on a tack, from your foot to your spinal cord via nerves. In fact, it reaches that and your muscles contract to get you the hell away from the attack even before you feel it, because you're not going to feel it until that information reaches the brain. But it goes to the spinal cord and then jerks it away even before you feel it. That's very fast-acting control. The endocrine system, on the other hand, operates via signals that are chemical, not electrochemical. And these are things like hormones. Hormones are chemicals that act as signals, but that get put into the bloodstream and therefore get broadcast throughout the body. You know, nervous signals, those electrochemical action potentials is what they're called, those are sent to a specific place. Hormones are broadcast throughout the body. So all, you know, since almost all cells get a blood supply, that means all the cells of the body receive these endocrine signals, these hormones. But they don't all react. They don't all even know that that signal is there. And that's because for a chemical signal to work, to have any effect, it has to bind to a molecule that we call a receptor, which is a specialized kind of protein. Has just the right shape for that chemical signal to fit in. Well, only certain cells have those receptors. So even though that hormone might reach all the cells, it's only going to have an effect on the cells that actually are able to receive it. Similarly, radio waves are coming through this room all the time, continuously, going through your body, going through these walls. But only if you have a receiver for those radio waves will you hear any music or news broadcast or whatever. Anyway, those are the two major control systems of the body, the nervous system and the endocrine system. Endocrine system is not only different because it's chemical versus electrochemical, but it's also a slower response and a much longer lasting response. So each of these controls all 9 in different ways, all 9 of the other organ systems. But to make it an even more exquisite control, each of the two control systems also controls the other control system. So the endocrine system has an effect on the nervous system has an effect on the endocrine system, and they both affect everything else. Another thing let me quickly say about the nervous system is that there's a hierarchy in the structure of the nervous system as well. You've probably heard the phrase central nervous system, right? You have the overall nervous system, but it's made of two major parts, the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. Central nervous system is just the brain and the spinal cord. The peripheral nervous system is the nerves that connect to those structures. So all of it combined is the nervous system. Anyway, we'll take a closer look at that system later. Well, the endocrine system that I just mentioned is shown in slide 9. This one is spread out over much of the body, has a diverse set of parts, many of which are glands, which makes sense because glands produce things for to be secreted or released from those glands. Well, those things that are produced and secreted by endocrine glands are the hormones I was talking about. And they travel via the bloodstream to all parts of the body. Now, speaking of the bloodstream, slide 10 shows us the system that is misnamed on this slide. Notice that it says cardiovascular system. And you might have used this term before. It is a term, but the cardiovascular system is not a complete organ system. Now, think about what the word means. What does cardio mean? Heart. And vascular is the adjective of what word? Vessel. So cardiovascular literally means heart and vessels, heart and blood vessels. And that's it. That's the only thing that's included in what we call the cardiovascular system. Confusingly, it's called a system. It is a system, but it's not an organ system. It's only the heart and the blood vessels. If you want to include everything that's in the organ system, then you have to include the blood as well. The blood is not part of the cardiovascular system, but if you include the blood and the heart and vessels, then you have the complete organ system, and that's called the circulatory system. So call it circulatory system, not cardiovascular system. All right, the blood is included. And this is, you know, the cardiovascular system is all about transporting things. We are huge organisms. There's plenty of examples of things that are bigger than we, of course, but compared to most organisms, we're really big. And we're thick also. So those 100 trillion cells we were talking about, most of them are not right at the surface. They're deep within our body. So we need to be able to get materials to all those cells. Therefore, we have to have a fluid that convects or gets pumped through the body. That's what the circulatory system is all about. The heart is that pump. The vessels are the chambers through which that blood flows. And the blood actually carries a bunch of things. It carries oxygen to the cells. It carries carbon dioxide away from the cells. It carries nutrients from the digestive system to the cells of the body. It carries toxins from and waste products from the cells to other systems. There's all kinds of things that get carried by the blood continuously, including heat, like I mentioned before. Heat gets moved around in the body via blood. All right. The lymphatic system is shown on slide 11. And this is the kind of the forgotten system by people who are not anatomists by trade. You know, I told you there are 11 organ systems, and if I were to ask you to come up with them rather than me telling you what they are, given enough time, you probably would have come up with almost all of them, maybe 10. I mean, you might have come up with all 11, I don't know, but If you didn't come up with all 11, chances are the one that's missing would have been the lymphatic system, because people kind of forget that we have a whole separate set of tubes running alongside our blood vessels. Those are lymphatic vessels. And they don't carry blood, they carry lymph. That's why it's called the lymphatic system. But what is lymph? Well, it actually comes from blood. The circulatory system carries the blood, like we've talked about. And remember, I was talking about those hormones. Those hormones need to be able to leave the blood in order for them to reach their target tissue so they have their effects. They can't stay locked in the vessels, or they wouldn't do any work. So that means the circulatory system, even though it's called a closed circulatory system, is not completely sealed. It has to be at least partially leaky. So you're continuously, slowly leaking fluid out of your blood through the vessels and creating swelling, or what would become swelling if you allowed it to continue, if you allowed it to build up. That's what we call that edema. Swollen ankles, for instance, that's edema, a buildup of tissue, of fluid that has leaked out of the circulatory system. Well, if we didn't have a system in place to deal with that leakage of fluid, we would quickly die from this edema. So the lymphatic system is important just for that reason alone. It's not the only thing it does. But this fluid that leaks out of the blood that we call lymph gets recollected by the lymphatic vessels, which then are like rivers, right? They combine into bigger and bigger vessels until eventually they come back to the circulatory system at the shoulders and dump that fluid back into the bloodstream. So, yes, we're continuously leaking, but we're dealing with that leakage continuously for a normal human. That's one major function, but the lymphatic system is also really important for immunity, what we call immunity. Now, here's another thing I should tell you about terminology. Cardiovascular system is not a true organ system, and also there is no organ system called the immune system. We use the phrase immune system, but it's not an organ system. What we call the immune system is really just the way that various parts of various organ systems function for the purpose of immunity. But there is no dedicated organ system called the immune system. It involves many different organ systems, but much of the job of immunity is dealt with by structures that are part of the lymphatic system. So immunity is a major function of the lymphatic system, along with reclaiming the lymph. 12 is the respiratory system, which I wish had been called the ventilatory system rather than the respiratory system, because respiration is really something that happens at the cells. What we do with our lungs is ventilate, but we call it respiration also, which leads to confusion. Anyway, that's why it's called the respiratory system. We take in air each inhalation. We exhale air each exhalation. But why are we doing that? Why are we breathing? Right, we bring in air, but really what we want from that air is the oxygen, right? Now, I ask this question in all my courses, including mostly biology majors that I teach, so don't feel bad if you don't know the answer to this, because even they can usually not answer this. It seems like a simple question, but why do we need oxygen? And the answer is not because we'll die without it. That's just another way of saying that we need it. Yeah. Well, the blood is important for delivering that oxygen, but the blood would flow whether we're putting oxygen into it or not. The fact that the blood is flowing is why the oxygen gets from the lungs to the rest of the body. The cells throughout the body require that oxygen. But what is it that oxygen actually does for us?
Pumps the heart, heals the system.
Well, specifically what it does, let me just jump to the answer. Specifically what it does is allow for hydrogen atoms that have been stripped from our food in order to get energy out of that food to be put somewhere. In order to get energy out of our food, we need to be able to dismantle the molecules that those food are made, the food's made out of. And whatever the food is, there's a bunch of carbon and hydrogen atoms in it. It's all organic stuff, organic chemicals. So there's a bunch of carbons and hydrogens. If you're able to pick the hydrogens off of that carbon skeleton, then you can get energy out of that. But you have to be able to put those somewhere. Each hydrogen atom is really an electron and a proton, which we'll talk about more later. But anyway, that comes from the food. We get energy by sending the electrons down what are called electron transport chains. And it's okay if you don't understand what I'm saying here. But at the end of that chain, in order for the chain not to fill up, the last member of that chain needs to be able to give that electron to something else. That's what oxygen does. It receives the electrons and the protons from the food that we eat as hydrogen atoms. And when that happens, when we add those hydrogens to oxygen, we make water. So by getting the energy from our food, we turn the oxygen that we breathe into water. And by the way, what's left over of the food, if we completely dismantle that and get as much energy as possible out of it, the only thing that's left of the food is carbon dioxide. That's where the carbon dioxide comes from. That's why you get rid of that. It's worthless as far as energy is concerned. We've already gotten all the energy we can out of that food. So the carbon dioxide then gets put into the blood by the cells of the body as waste product. That goes back to the lungs, the blood, and the carbon dioxide gets delivered to the interior of the lungs and we get rid of that. Then the next breath we bring in fresh air, which has more oxygen, send the oxygen to the rest of the body, do the same thing over and over again. That's the respiratory system. Now I guess I need to stop there.